All great Sufi doctrine is based on the idea that when something physical happens on the world, on the earth, it has a spiritual significance, so that nothing should be allowed to get by in the material world without an interpretation of a spiritual type. And when I was coming back from my, quote, holiday, on the boat, there was a man and his wife who, if we had met them earlier, would undoubtedly have engaged us in conversation, but we didn't meet them until we were docking. And he came in with great verve and said, "The next time you give a talk in the Isle of Man on anything psychological, will you please make it under the heading Sex After Death?" After marriage. And I said, "The first title is the best." I rather like that title. Now, you see, without that chance encounter with that man, this title would never have come into being, would it? Sex After Death. And it was beginning to recede as possibly too high and fine to be discussed than in normal human beings, when a very famous psychiatrist said to me, "That's a very good title." Just when it was about to recede, he said, "That's a very good title. Shall we have that on Sunday?" Now, I had already committed myself to use the brown pencil on Sunday, not the blue one. So I said, "I'll talk about both together." So I got a brown pencil for earthly matters and a blue one for the intellectual world. And which one shall I begin with, the brown one or the blue one? The brown, because we are all basically egotists, and the word own is in the word brown. And you know, when you're browned off, it means that your ego has been flattened by events. And you should always go from the known to the unknown. And we know the brown much better than the blue, so we will begin with the brown. So I will switch on this horrible device, which I organically detest, but spiritually I'm very fond of. And I will hope that this weird brown pen has not dried itself up in the last 2 months. If it has, we will go straight on to the blue. I'm going to draw a bit of a Sumerian-type portrait. This is a man, rather handsome man, actually, in the old days. Now, I'm drawing this brown man so that we can think we are talking about an earthly fact. And inside this brown man, I'm going to put three kinds of soul. This is a medieval diagram brought up to date in the Renaissance and frequently cribbed, stolen by mystics who want to make a cheap, free from copyright book by ransacking the British Museum. Anyhow, this particular diagram is very useful for our purpose. And I'm going to show that coming in through the top of the head there are certain forces which do a very peculiar thing like that. And I'm going to put ratio in here. Strictly that should be blue, but I'm not going to unscrew the blue pen just for one word, because I'm a natural economist. Now, pure ratio has nothing whatever to do with the brown world. It has to do with certain principles of vibration in the absolute sentient power. Ratio implies a differentiation of power which proceeds inevitably because of the inherent nature of power itself. So that if we talk rationally, we necessarily talk inevitably, logically, unavoidably, rigidly, so that the rational being, like the Greek Stoic, is essentially a being whose mind is tuned in with pure logic, a logic of inevitability, the logic of form. We will see what that means later on. Inside here, I'm going to put a C for cognition, and I'm going to put an E for evaluation there. And I'm going to say this at the rational level of pure logic, where the whole is greater than the parts, and the parts cannot be separately as great as the whole, and show that when you cognize a logical truth, like a triangle has three sides and three internal angles, you also evaluate the relationship in a very peculiar way. Has this pure logic got hold of the soul? If so, then the functioning of this kind of mind says, when I cognize a proposition, when I get hold of it, cogitate on it, and I see that a triangle has three sides, do I evaluate the three sides? Say this side is equal to this side is equal to this side. If I evaluate it instead of just staring at it, then I have a double function, cognition and evaluation. Now, where the cognition and the evaluation overlap, a soul appears. I'm going to write S for soul in there, and that soul is a product. It's a product, a soul as product of cognition and evaluation. Let's think about that very carefully. Whenever you consider a purely logical proposition, like a triangle has three sides, a square has four sides, and then you evaluate the parts of that thing to see if it is really true. You say a triangle has three sides. I will verify. One side, two sides, three sides. Yes? And the definition is a triangle has three sides. This has three sides and three angles here. Then, in seeing this, evaluating this side is verily a side, and this side is another side, and this third side, verily it is a third side, I'm evaluating these lines and calling them sides. If I was to cut them at the corners and separate them and push them to an infinite distance and alter their directions, I could say the triangle has vanished. But when I put them back together again in this relation, relation is the basis of ratio, when I put them into this relation, then I see that the triangle is a self-defining thing. I see that to define the triangle as a three-sided figure is already a tautology, because triangle implies three angles. But I evaluate it in such a way that whatever I say, yea, verily, it is so. So that if I say triangles have three sides, you can all say, so what? It is self-evident that triangles have three sides. Nevertheless, that is a very, very important part of the function of a human being. And where the cognition process, that is the actual exposure of oneself, of the sentient field, to the fact a triangle occurs, where that cognition occurs, there is a circle of cognition, where the evaluation occurs, as when we say, yea, verily, this is a triangle, it has three sides, one, two, three, and three angles. Where these two processes overlap, there comes into being the rational soul. We have a soul which is rational. Now, a soul is an encapsulated zone of sentient power. Sentient power absolutely is spirit. Spirit is self-moving, self-initiating. It is not called soul until we encapsulate it. And when the encapsulation occurs in this zone, through the overlapping of cognition and evaluation, there comes into being a soul. That is an encapsulated zone of sentient power. Now, at the back of the head here, we will put another such zone, and on the one side of it we will have memory, and on the other side motivation. I'll put MT for motivation and MR for memory. Now, memory, from the individual point of view, is a storehouse of things that have happened to the individual. So that when he remembers something and remembers that he had motivation the first time he did it, then in remembering the motivation and the fact of memory, there appears in between these again another soul. And this is a very mechanical soul. It is a soul, it is a zone of encapsulated sentient power, but nevertheless, mysteriously, it is entirely mechanical, because it is based on things that have happened before and the recurrence of the motivations of those things. Supposing you sneeze without bothering to put your elbow to your nose, which is very difficult. If you do that straight into the face of the lady opposite, and she promptly brings down a brolly on your nappy, having your napper, sorry, and when she does this, you experience pain. Later on, when you're sitting opposite to a lady in one of our British trains, and you are about to sneeze, there suddenly appears a pain in the head, which is the remembered pain of the brolly landing, and your motivation then is altered by the previous experience. You remember that if you sneeze full into the lady's face, the brolly will come down. And this is a closed situation. It is memory. And memory is a zone of recorded experience vibrating, waiting to be triggered. And when it is triggered, when the motivation for your previous act, the motivation in the case of sneezing is irritation somewhere up in the nose, when that motivation is there, and there comes a pain from the brolly, the dislike for the pain may overrule the irritation in the nose that would cause you to sneeze. And you may actually cover your face or not bother to sneeze at all. But your behavior there would be entirely mechanical. So in the back of the head there, you have a mechanical soul. That is a zone of sentient power. That is the definition of the soul, which is entirely mechanical. It runs on memory of previous experiences of pleasures and pains. Now, in the forebrain up here, we have another soul. This time, we have sensation. I'll put an N on it, there, little N. And we have imagination. I'll put IMA for that. And we have another soul. Now this is a very, very interesting kind of soul, because it takes the data of sense from the external world, the five senses, the things you have smelled, tasted, seen, touched, and heard. Those are the sensations, and it proceeds to manipulate these images and produce new types of imagery. And this is the power of the imagination. So we have another kind of soul, a soul that is able to manipulate sense data or data, whichever dictionary you use, and in this process to produce invention. Now this is the brown. This is the earthly being. This is what is encapsulated in the head of this man. But of course, the stimuli coming to the senses there come from outside, from the external physical world. The powers of the imagination come from outside. The powers of pure intellect come from outside, And very mysteriously, the memories of customary behaviors and motivations also come from outside. So we can now say there must be an origin for those, an origin for this, an origin. Yes? Now, when we think about the origin of this, we have said many times that the universe is made out of the debris of prior universes. We cannot make a universe except by using matter that has been used before and conditioned in some degree by the way it's been used before in another universe. So whatever comes in to our memory comes in from the universal substance. The universe has memory like the individual human being. And the individual human being has a memory which egotism thinks is private, but really it isn't. It is merely a portion of the universal. So I'm going to cover up the brown now so that it doesn't dry up, and bring out the blue. I bring out the blue because blue is the symbolic color of intellect. Because blue, unlike red, doesn't activate you. And it doesn't make you cheerful like yellow does. What it does do is leave you cool. And the essence of the intellective process is that it is conducted in a cool mind, more efficiently than in a hot one, and that it belongs to a world which is cool. A world which is not urgefully dashing about. It is a world of evaluation. So I'm going to say, imagine now that in this intellective world here, there are forces in perfect balance. So I shall call this, what shall we call it? The world of noumena. Isn't that blue lovely? Which do you prefer, the brown or the blue? All those who prefer brown are fond of comfort. All those who prefer blue are naturally inclined to the truth. If you've got a bit of a bias either way, you know how to evaluate. Now, in the noumenal world, this word noumena really means names. You see, in that world, there is a mysterious sign like that. It is the sign of the Trinity, of power, of form, of function. In the Christian Trinity, the power is God the Father, the form is God the Son, the function is the Holy Ghost. In Hindu doctrine, the power is Ishwar, and the preservative form is Vishnu, and the functioning process is Brahma. Well, it's easier for us to say, because of our conditioning, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The important thing is to know what we're talking about. There is a noumenal world, a world of pure forms. And in this world of pure forms, there is nothing there that is not true, absolutely. And there are seraphim and cherubim and dominions and thrones, powers, principles, virtues, all kinds of things. But here, just coming down to the base of the noumenal world, in order to deliver the noumenal contents into the brown man, there is a place marked a poor angel. When Christ said the angels of the little ones continuously face their Father in heaven, he meant to say that the top level of human intelligence is divine. So that if you climb up in your consciousness to the highest reach of pure reason, you come to a level that is called the angel. It is you, your guardian angel. You are your guardian angel. This is not to be confused with the guardian angel of certain types of profane orthodoxy, which says the guardian angel is another being detailed enough to look after you. There isn't any such guardian angel. The real guardian angel is your highest intelligence. That is you, why you actually receive the recommendations of pure ratio. We'll see what that means in a moment. But here we have a world, and we can just put in this circle, custom. Now, custom is an interesting word. You can translate it case, tummy. This thing down here, cased. Remember, all the experiences of prior universes have been involved into the substance of this universe, and they have created a case of tummy behavior. That is a mechanically rolling kind of reactivity, mechanical reactivity. It is in the universe. If I tap this, you hear a noise. Why do you hear a noise? That's supposed to be a mineral body. This is another one. I tap them, and they say knock, knock. Why do they do that? It's a bad habit they've got. Now, to get to that level, they must have done it very, very often before. That is energy, and this is energy, in a certain form of compaction. And when the energy there compacted is brought into conjunction with another energy forcefully, there is a sound called knocking. But this is merely a habit which has been cultivated through compaction of power in many, many prior universes. So there is, outside the brown man, outside the earth man, there is a universe of customary responses. And it posits itself through the memory and motivation of man and breeds a mechanically reactive soul. It's that mechanically reactive soul that causes trouble to men like Enoch Powell today. Because human beings in England for some years were brought up to believe that white men were superior to black men, and their governments encouraged them to believe that, and now the linear descendants of those government bodies are saying it is no longer true that colored people are human beings like white people. But the customary way of reacting to colored people is so deeply ingrained in large numbers of the population that they cannot break out of it. So much so that if a Negro buys a house, the first house in a row of respectably priced houses, all the prices go down. That's custom, and it's entirely reactive. Now, over here we have a world, and this world I'm going to call the middle world, and it is the world in which imagination rules a peculiar relation between the noumenal world and the world of sense objects. That's the world of sense objects. That's the one you call physical world. Now, this middle world is the world in which you manipulate sense objects. And you look into the world of pure noumenal forms, where all the triangles live, and the squares, and the hexagons, and so on, and you apply them to sense objects. Let me give you a little example. Supposing I go to the noumenal world, and I find a triangle, and I take it out of the noumenal world, and I draw that triangle. And then I look into the sense world, and I see a figure of a man, and I copy it simply like that. There's a man. And I see a figure of a woman, and I copy it like that. There's a woman. And I see a similar one, only much tinier, and I call that a child. Now, I have placed inside a triangle borrowed from the noumenal world. Remember, world means an orderly system bound into a unity. I have borrowed the triangle and I have inserted into the triangle some sense object from the physical world. Right? So that I can make, with my imagination, with my middle world, I can make designs. I can say, I will make a half drop repeat, and I will keep repeating this design, might invert it like that, and keep carrying it down the paper until I fill it up. And I will make a geometrical pattern, and the geometry has been borrowed from the noumenal world. But the sensible objects represented have been borrowed from the physical world. And I have a special world, the world of creative imagination, that artists use more than they use anything else. They bring into relation the noumenal geometrical facts, which are eternal, with the objective external physical facts, which are temporal. So we have a very special middle world in which creative imagination can manipulate things. This is the world in which great inventors and great artists and great composers work. You can't understand a Beethoven sonata unless you know something of noumenal form. And you can't play it when you do understand it unless you have a gross material object like a piano or a violin or a cello and so on. You must bring together a noumenal, geometrical, purely logical proposition with an external sense object. And to do this intelligently, you must be creatively imaginative. Or art therapy depends on the proper use of creative imagination. And these worlds have their representatives inside the skull of man. So we have a very special kind of soul in the mind of man here, a soul that is dedicated to the creative imaginative manipulation of sense objects and noumenal geometrical forms. Now, to let that soak into the understanding, to become aware that these functions are really here, inside us, and then to realize that the most important world of all is that middle world, the world between the noumenal and the sense world. This one over here is inertia of prior universes. Let that soak into the mind, and then we will go towards the other parts of our discussion. We'll do a slightly large drawing of the noumenal world. Have you all got those photographed in your mind so that you can remember them? Yes. Now, in the noumenal world, there is a very peculiar thing. It is so simple that it is absolutely dazzling in its simplicity. In the noumenal world, there are nothing except an infinity of interlaced circles. Now, if I draw one circle like this, and then get a pair of compasses, and I put one foot on there and one there, and go around this circle to make it, and then I take that same compass and shift the center from there and put it here and move it around the circle, it will cut this circle in a very simple way. I'm going to put a dot there, 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 and there. Now that will do roughly to represent what we want. These are places I move my compass to, or to which I move my compass. Now, I take the compass from the center and I put it here, and I draw another circle that goes through that center and through that one and does that. And then I go to this one and I draw another center. Sorry, I go to this one like this. Then I go to this one like this. Then I go to this one like this. I go to this one like this, and then I go to this one like this, and I have produced a six-petaled flower appearance in the middle. Now the essential thing about this is that this little diagram can be extended throughout the whole plane of existence infinitely without any change. In other words, wherever there is an intersection, I can start drawing another circle, so that I can draw from here through there and round there. Now it's quite obvious that if I go on doing this, I am going to have a process in which the center here is arguing with the center there about whether there shall be dictatorship of this area from that center or from this center. I'm going to make it slightly simpler. Can you visualize that I can go on drawing and covering the whole surface of this sheet of perspex with exactly that pattern? And I want you to observe that each circle has six petals appearing within it. But those petals do not deserve to be called real petals because they are not self-determinant. Those petals are an appearance of these overlapping circles. There are no petals there, are there? They're just circles. But we look, and because we are central beings who tend to center our consciousness, we look for centers. So I'm going to take that out of the way a moment. I'm going to draw a circle again and another one like that and another one like that, and I'm going to examine that and see that this center and this one and this one have equal claim to dictate what happens inside that triangle. Can you see that there is a triangle here which can be stable? Because this point of authority, each center is a point of authority, can say, I believe that what I say in here shall be determined by me. This one says, I believe it shall be determined by me. And this one says, I believe it shall be determined by me. So we have a zone there which is overlapping with three authorities. Three is very useful, because if any given one of them tries to overrule the situation, the other two can gang up against it. Now, if I were to draw only two circles like this, and this authority and this one said, I am going to determine what happens in this zone, I will dominate it, and the other one says, well, my vibrations will spread out and dominate it, you would have a contested zone there. In psychology, you might draw it like this, simply, and put a Greek letter psi, psi, there, and say that psi zone is the contested zone where there are only two authorities, and the whip passes momently from hand to hand. This center says, I'm the boss here, and this other center says, no, you're not, I am. Now, unless we add a third point to it, here are the two circles overlapping, and there'd be continuous fighting about who is dominating this zone. Yeah. But if we say, let's make another center here and do that, this one can say, if you are too bossy, I will gang up with this one. And if you are too bossy, I will gang up with this one. And each one of them can say, and if you do that, we will do it with you if you try to be too bossy. This is the basis of the politics of perfidious Albion. Always side with the other fellow who is least likely to dominate the situation in order to balance it. Now, if we go back to this six-petal thing, we are going to look at it a little more carefully. The Latin for six, sex, has a Greek equivalent, hex. Now, hex simply means six. Sex means six. And we're going to talk about sex after death, by which I mean after the death of the brown man. When the brown body is deserted, the earth body, the forces that were resident in it and conducted themselves in the manner called sexually polarized behavior, they do not cease to exist. They're not annihilated. They're really still there. But they're now in another level. The Romans call that word sex because they were a separative nation. They liked taxing and they liked power and they liked separativity and they liked superiority and so on. Now the Greeks didn't like that sound, so they used this other sound, hex, which implies a hierarchy of power. So that if we talk about a hexagon, we are talking about a six-sided figure. And we can draw straight lines from these petals, like this. And we can do an operation called enclosing that lotus of the six petals in a hexagon. Now, I'm going to move this up a bit and enlarge the diagram. So have a look at it slightly more closely. There is a circle. There's its center. And this can be extended throughout infinite space. We see immediately that we've written the word io. The dot is the letter I, and we put a line under it to show where it is. And the O is the O. Now, O symbolizes to comprehend, to encircle, to contain. And the I symbolizes to initiate, to posit a form within that O, within that zone of power, to posit a form. So that when I put that dot inside that O, you can think to yourself, this is the name of God, Yo, very old name of God. It's the same Yo in Yehovah, Jehovah. The Greek Io, the name of Pan, the God of all nature. If I shift my compass to here, I draw a circle that goes through the center and this point, goes out and round here. If I put it here, I go round here, again. I put it here, and I go round through here, like this. I put the compass there, and I go like this. I put the compass there, and I go like this. And I put the compass there, and I go like this. Now we've got it slightly larger. Now, we said that at any intersection point whatever, like that, because of the mutual interference of the circles with each other, a new center is posited, and that new center can do exactly the same thing that the others did. So it can go through two points there and start another circle here. And it can proceed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 as before, and build up a new kind of flower like this. And we see immediately that this center here can claim a portion here of this territory. Let's just shade that little bit in a moment. That's a contested zone. Now, what happens if this, remember, all is sentient power. This is a field of sentient power. What happens if this center of initiative, this Yod or Jot, decides to dominate this zone by increasing energy input? It says, this is my territory, I will dominate it. And it begins to vibrate. Then, to its surprise, another zone down here has started the same campaign, so that this zone is contested by both of them. Now, I want you to think very, very carefully about this. This design can be extended infinitely through space. It is a design we will call hexic, a design of sixness throughout infinite space. Those of you who know anything about Tantra will recognize this diagram, the six-petaled diagram, which is used for a certain kind of meditation. Now, if this gives an order that this circle shall be the empire under the dominion of this center, and this center gives the order this shall be the empire under the dominion of this one, then there is a contested zone. Now, it is quite impossible in all eternity for that circle to get rid of any other circle. All the circles are co-eternal. So it cannot get rid of this other center that is interfering. There are other centers, there's one over here, and so on, contesting this zone, and so on. There's another contesting this zone. But I won't mark the diagram up and make it too complicated, because if I cover that up, you will find that your eye will start flickering because it cannot rest. Can you see already that if you look at that, the eye tends to be led to this zone of contested ownership? That if I draw this other circle here, already we're in grave danger. Another center over here. And we get an effect rather like the effect a stroboscope has on you. It makes you quite dizzy. If you remember that the retina in the eye is full of little devices for receiving light pointing at you, and that they're arranged in this manner, you can see why stimulating that retina in a certain rhythmical way produces sensations of wheelings round and round. You see the hexic nature of perception in it. Now, I want you to realize that a soul is nothing but an encapsulated zone of sentient power. So this zone of power, encapsulated, is a soul. And the center of that soul there is its will, from which it receives tribute from six other circles, which, through their overlapping of that center, reinforce it. They make it vigorous because they stimulate it in a sixfold manner. So it feels very much that it exists, that it has energy, that it can give orders up to the limit of this authority, will be its empire. But it cannot get rid of the other circles. Impossible. When Christ said the poor have you always with you, me, not always. This is what he meant. The poor are the beings in the contested zone who haven't got that opportunity for formulating a center. If you get a little people in a little valley between two great nations, and the great nations are making propaganda against each other, and they create for their own labor problems inside their own territories what they call border incidents, the border incidents rip up the ground in which that small people live, and that small people can do nothing about it because they haven't got the power. So imagine a situation in which perhaps this is Russia and perhaps that is China, and here is a border incident. There isn't sufficient power or centrality there for that zone to say to these two, shut up, I am going to start dominating. From the very nature of the problem, the poor have you always with you. There will always be zones of contested authority between central authorities. St. Paul called this strong meat not fit for babies. Because if you happen to be born in one of those territories, say like the Swiss, you have to say, imperialism is no good to me, I'll make cuckoo clocks. As Orson Welles was once given some lines to say in The Third Man. The fact is, you either do nothing and perish negatively, or you make some kind of capital out of it. And certainly you cannot be a super authority in an imperialistic sense unless you happen to be at the center of a certain terrain on the earth. And those centers are determined geometrically, hexically. So now let's look what happens. Supposing this center is doomed eternally to stay where it is, and so are all the other centers, but to keep the diagram simple, we've only got two. Then this one gives orders, all this territory is mine, my voice only shall be heard, you see. And in this zone, there's another voice saying, all this territory is mine, mine only shall be heard, etc., etc. And you can't stop it. So they have to do what they call coming to terms. So they start shooting intercontinental ballistic missiles along here. Look at that diagram very carefully, because that diagram explains to you exactly how your spinal column came into being. Your spinal column is a track along which intercontinental ballistic missiles called afferent and efferent nervous impulses are thrown from one center to another and back again. Now, because of the law of the inequality of finites, this particular hexic, when we say hexic, we mean six-fold empire, cannot have the same power as this one. It must be either greater or lesser in authority. And because it can't get rid of the other one, it must learn to live with it, to trade with it. So it establishes authority. Now let's assume that this one is called the winner, and this one is called the next one, running up in second place for world imperial intentions. This winner is going to give the orders along this line and say, I will never give that territory up, and I am stronger than you, and therefore you must allow me to have the formal say. But because I can't get rid of you, I will allow you to import from your territory melons in good condition. That's called a unilateral trade agreement. Now consider what happens. We have two authorities here, neither of which can be eliminated, and we have a line of energy going backwards and forwards across it, producing a roadway around which energy is spinning all the time. But one of them is defined by the other as the not giver of the orders. The one that is defined as the giver of the orders by itself is called the North Center. I'll put an N there above it to remind you. N. The North, the Nous, the intelligence, the one that says, I give the orders. And the other one replies, well, you can't make me not exist. If you give the orders, I will provide the amusements. So, if you export hardware, like Concords and heavy machinery, I will create brothels, so that when they get to the end of the line, they'll have something to do other than think about Concord. So we have here a southern center, and this southern center is concerned with sensuous enjoyment. We have a northern center that gives orders, and the southern center that provides enjoyment. And between these two centers, there is a continuous passage of energy. Now, we were talking about sex after death. When you leave your gross physical body, the same powers that in the physical body, when they were relating, were thought of as sexual, are now hexual. They're still here, the same forces. They have exactly the same relation as before, but without the inertia of the gross material world. Let us say, in this hexic world, it is possible to go over the Howling Wall far more easily than it is on Earth, because there is no inertia. You can imagine yourself with a creative imagination through the wall. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also. So in this world, remember, here is a soul, a being, which has established itself as a supreme authority. Supposing this is a soul that has been incarnated on Earth and got itself tied up in a brown body for a time and got a lot of experience and now has come back into its hexic state with all the lessons that it learned whilst it was on Earth. It is an authority in so many things that when it's left its brown Earth body behind, it still has this same authority. It has evolved into its being, into its experience, through its power of interpretation, through its power of bringing together the noumenal world and the sense world through the creative imagination. It has this power to dominate even after death. So it's in this noumenal world, which some people call heaven, but really should be called the supersensual world, of the highest order, that noumenal world. In that world, that man who has established himself, or that woman, or that being, whatever it is, that has established itself whilst on Earth through experience involvement, through digestion of experience, and has established inner authority so that the north center in that being is able to dictate to the south center in that being, then he has the power to dictate in the noumenal world, the world of spirit, also in exactly the same way. But the power that was sensuous and providing the amusements, and never make that moral error of thinking that the sensuous amusements are inferior in any way to the noumenal geometrics. This one can say, I supply in the spiritual world the sensuous delights, although in a very refined manner, much more subtle than on Earth, that correspond exactly with your noumenal or purely logical offerings. So we now have a situation in which, after the withdrawal from the physical body, a person of authority who gives orders is still in the same kind of relationship with the being to whom he gives orders and who supplies him with sensuous delights that an empire was in on Earth when it gave orders, laws, and another center that might have been an empire gave sensuous delights. Now, the rule of the microcosm, macrocosm is there is nothing in the big universe that is not in the little universe. There is nothing in the universe that is not in the individual man, and nothing that is not in the relation that he has with every other being to whom he is related. So if a man has a relation with a woman in the brown world of earth matters, that same relationship is established in the hexic world. So if that man thoroughly understands the necessities of the sensuous relaxers, remember Billy Blake saying, damn and bless, he damns tensions and blesses relaxes, because the tension here of creating an entirely rigid, purely logical form requires you to relax. Because if you didn't relax, you would be blocked by the logic of the truth. You must be able to make a true proposition and then let go of it to relax. Damn, braces, bless, relaxes, says Blake. So when you get into this hexic world, the spiritual world after death, you still have the same relation and the same relational problem that you had on earth with the beings to whom you were related. You still have to say, if I'm the one who gives the orders, I'm the one that does the bracing and the geometry and the logic, then I am sacrificed to form, and another being is sacrificed to sensuous delights. And we had better get together and understand this, because if we don't, two horrible things are going to happen. The one that gives the orders is going to become entirely rigid, and the one that's merely sensuous is going to lose all form absolutely and become a non-existent flux of sentience. So that the hexic post-mortem condition is this: if a man and a woman have organized a relationship whilst on earth between them, in which they have intelligently recognized that he is to give intelligent orders, not rubbish orders, really intelligent, noumenal orders, she is to relax him from the orders. And as payment for her relaxing him, he gives the orders. And as payment for him giving her the orders, she relaxes him. Now, if we imagine, we put a Saturn down for the tension, and we put a Jupiter for the relaxing. And we remember that in the process of creation, the movement inwards towards Saturn is the creation of a tension, and the movement outwards towards Jupiter is a relaxing. As the movement comes in, tension increases. As it goes out, it relaxes. Tension increases. Out relaxes. Tension increases. Out relaxes, and so on. Here's your hexic world again. Now you'll observe that Saturn, the word means the urn of being, provides the center of reference. And Jupiter, the expansive force, provides the movement towards the periphery, and both together, in their continuity of continuous repositings, because that center is not static, it is continuously reposited. That's called the world being created instantly from moment to moment, dissembled, recreated, dissembled, recreated, dissembled, recreate, dissembled, recreate. Every moment of time is a repositing of your intention, and that is Saturnine. So now, to make a slightly simpler version of it, we will have a center there with a circle, and we'll have a center here with a circle, and we'll have a spine here. And we will say, this is the female pole, south, and that's the male pole, north. Here is the origination of your spinal column, and forces are going up it and down it. They're called the forces that ride up and down in the battle with Jacob and the angel. There are angels or messages from the luminal world going up and down your spine. Some go to the brain, some go from the brain. The ones from the brain give orders to the body, the ones to the brain give information to the brain. So this relationship within the individual is the same as the relationship between two individuals. There is a woman, she believes that is her physical body. There is a man, he believes that is his physical body. The woman knows by immediate feeling that the center of her intelligence is the womb, the uterus. The man believes that his brain is the center of him. So he tends to think from here, and the woman to feel from the uterine level. The two functions are absolutely essential to each other. And thoroughly to realize that is to remove this ridiculous conflict of woman's lib, man's lib, and so on. That little diagram shows you that if you identify with your physical body, there is a field of energy around that body, and that energy field is trying to feel what is going on inside another body. So supposing that north point is a man's physical body and the south point is a woman's physical body, and there's a little center there, the uterus, and there's a little center there, the brain. This uterine intelligence, because there is such a power, uterine intelligence, is very busy radiating and feeling out to find out what is going on in the brain of man. And the brain intelligence of the man is trying to rationalize what is going on inside the uterine brain of the woman. Now think how difficult relation is. Using the brain with the three brains and three souls that we had in the earlier Brown diagram, the man is going from custom, from logic, and from creative imagination to try to find out what is going on in that uterine intelligence. And that uterine intelligence is trying to feel what machine-like processes are going on in the brain of man. Now, we cannot change the position of any one of these circles. When we did that process before, and we had our flower like that, we can't shift that center to here. We can't shift it to there. We cannot shift them at all, so that we have an eternal relationship with each other that cannot be broken. And in time, you are put into relationships through an apparent dislocation. But this dislocation is not real. When you move your physical body about, this thing, within this hexic field, you do not move the field. What you can do is this. Supposing there is a body, and there is a body, and there is the field, lapping like this, you can, by straining yourself, push that body nearer to that body. In which case, your field is now distorted, and you are giving short orders on the one side and long orders on the other side. Like that. You dislocate your physical body, but you cannot dislocate your hexic reality. So that your relationship to the Absolute is utterly unbreakable. And your relationship with each other is absolutely unbreakable eternally. So whatever your eternal relation is, you will finish up your full evolution back in your own backyard, in the hexic field from which you started. Now to get there, you have to enter in the physical world into a polarized relationship. And whether that relationship consummates itself physically as a sexual gross material act or not is not tremendously important, but that every influence of one being on another at any of the five levels, physically, emotionally, practical rationality, cosmic logos, and willful, at any of those five levels, the relationship is sexual, hexual. That is to say, you cannot relate to another being without inserting power into that being, and in the process exposing yourself to that being. So that if there is your physical body, and there is another physical body, and there is your field, and there is the field of that being, you are in communicating, passing across here, and being exposed to a counter stimulus from the other being. So that you are both a giver and a receiver of energy. And when you are giving the energy, you call yourself a male in Europe, and when you are receiving it, you call yourself a female. Then that is a European stress, a dislocation. In India, in tantric philosophy, they do exactly the opposite thing. Imagine a situation in which one of these circles, remember there are an infinity of these, is here, there is a center, and there is a center, and the authority for this circle can come from this center, or it can come from that center. But it is sentient power. It cannot do nothing. It must do something. It must either give orders to that whole zone, or allow the other to give orders, or continuously fight the other for the dominion of that zone. The result is that between these two here, energy passes. And when it does so, it passes by quantum jumps. It passes by a spark action. A moment, an instant of energy shoots across that gap. So at every moment of your existence, you are giving orders and receiving orders from other beings. And this giving and receiving orders is sexual. Now, if we didn't do this, if we were to rub that out, imagine the situation. Kierkegaard describes this very well as a primary angst, an anxiety. There is a sentient power, and here is a sentient power, and naturally, from its own self, it wishes to condition itself in its own way without interference. But there is no such zone as a zone free from interference. All zones are interfered with infinitely. So the state of this being here is one of great anxiety, because this being is giving orders in the same zone. Now, if you look at that diagram, how do you feel psychologically? Suppose you identify with this point. How do you feel about this curve here? Does it make you feel uncomfortable? As if this chunk has been cut out of your world. Supposing you take this world here and imagine that this is all you've got left. Supposing you can't feel that anymore. Now, how do you feel? Are you happier to be shaped like that? Or do you feel like a cake with the bite taken out of it? The fact is that any sentient power that is not ruling its own territory to the full limits of its periphery is unhappy. So that when it feels this missing bit, it wants to restate it. And it wants, if possible, to weaken this one. But if it weakens it absolutely, the other one is now crescent in, has a piece bitten out of it, goes into anxiety and wants to bite back that chunk. Think about that, like a mouth, isn't it? Simply. Where the chunk has gone. The only reason you are hungry is because somebody's taken a bite out of your cake. And the only other cakes available are the ones they've got. There aren't any non-owned cakes about. All cakes are owned and spoken for. So everybody is biting at all the missing chunks. So the only intelligent thing to do is to say, all right, I bite and you bite, let's agree. I'll send a message, your turn to bite. You send a message, your turn to bite. And once we have established this is the game, you give me an order, I'll give you a delight. And he says, well, you give me a delight and I'll give you a nice order. And when you get to this level of hexic sexual relation, you have attained what is called supreme bliss, Ananda. That is the Parasamvit. This is a supreme state of sentient power, finally come to terms with itself. Now, if this center is absolutely certain that every time it gives a nice order, this one will devise a new kind of delight, it will spend its time thinking up nice new orders. But if this one gives a stupid order, that one will devise a kind of delight that will be quite undelightful. And that is justice. This one will pour porridge on the head of that one. If that one thinks that what's happening in Vietnam is more important than what's happening in number 43 Tewkesbury Lane in bed. So that when Thomas Carlyle was writing the French Revolution and the coffee poured over his head, that was justice. Because really the French Revolution wasn't so important compared with what was happening at home. He thought it was because he had glory and hero worship to deal with. But he'd really missed the point about that function within the home. So here we have a highly intelligent hexic relationship in which the so-called male has recognized the only reason that he is a male is because he has actually given more orders than the other one. More formal orders. And the only reason that she is a female is because she has accepted them and given delights in exchange for them. And at any given moment, if he gives a bad order, she can give an undelightful delight in exchange for it. And if she, in a moment of pique, gives a rotten type of sensuous delight, he can deliberately fabricate a rotten order. Now, this conflict is eternal. Unless they come to an intelligent agreement of polarization. Now, Tantra is very clever because it says, wouldn't it be a bit boring if we said that is the man giving orders and this is the woman taking them forever? If we are very intelligent, let's play a funny game. I'll give you a brilliant order, you give me a sensuous delight. And then, without warning me when, you give me an intelligent order and I'll give you a delight. Now that's much more interesting. Now the whip is passed deliberately from hand to hand. And the man says to the woman, give me an intelligent male order today. I'm feeling feminine. And she says, okay, but not today, because I'm still feminine from yesterday. Because yesterday you gave me a rotten order. And he said, okay, I was slipping a bit. But I take the rebuke, and we have a contested territory. We must come to terms, we must agree. Otherwise we shatter the household. Yes, quite right, dear. Yes, well then you give me an intelligent order now, says he to her, and I will find you a sensuous delight. And she, with brilliant sophic readiness, does so. And he immediately produces a brilliant, sensible order in a harmony range. But if that does not occur, if they're unaware of this true relationship, then he will try to protect and justify his rotten orders and explain why they were good, and she will try to show why all her attempts to delight him must fail by barriers of unpredictable menstruations, migraines, backaches, all kinds of things. She has an infinite number of weapons that she can use. If she and he intelligently comprehend each other's game in this contested area, you have heavenly harmony. And when you leave your brown bodies and go into infinity, into eternity, into the world of pure spirit, I never gave you the word sphotum then, you attain a degree of intelligent reciprocal interpenetration that at the physical level you wish for but cannot get. Now you know that every young pair of lovers have a peculiar urge and they cannot account for it. She says, I want to eat you completely. And he says, I want to do the same to you. This flesh is a barrier. We should be able to get nearer, 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 and out the other side. So, now this is simply because terrestrial beings remember their hexic relationship of absolute mutual interpenetration on all levels of being. And therefore, on the gross level, they try to attain it, and they're stopped by pubic bones and all kinds of things. All these are frustrating devices fabricated by the god of brownery to create the tension, to make you prefer to get back into the hexic relation from which you started.